For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
A science story, huh?
Is NYU a scientist? The
I felt it, and I just thought, well, I figured it out.
It was that golden moment
because science was on my side.
Hey everyone, I'm Ben Lilly, and welcome to the Story Collider, where we bring you true stories of how science has affected people's lives. This week's story is from Amy Cuddy. The story was recorded in May 2013 at the Bell House in Brooklyn as part of our 3-year anniversary celebration. Our 4-year anniversary is coming up. Head to storycollider.org for details.
When I went to college, I knew I was smart. It was pretty much the only thing that I knew about anything. But I felt like that was a safe thing, that it was fixed, that if I ever needed it, I could lean on it. I wasn't particularly driven. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I was totally okay with that because I felt like I would somehow, you know, meander along and bump into it and it would work out because I would always be smart and that would be okay. I mean, I was really just a typical college kid. I went to a state school. I wasn't fancy. You know, I worked low-wage jobs. I worked as a roller skating waitress for a while. I lived the summer that I turned 19, I lived in squalor, in a house that probably should have been condemned at the Jersey Shore. I lived with my friend from college, Blair, and the guys who ran the airbrush t-shirt stand at the boardwalk. It was awesome. And I mean, we were like cool. And Blair and I worked at the movie theater, and we actually lived on the popcorn that we would bring home in a garbage bag at the end of the night. And we actually had a room that was the popcorn room in this condemned house. And it was awesome. And I actually left, and my dad is here. And he didn't know this story until an hour ago. But I left in the middle of that summer before I turned 19. And I hitchhiked to Indiana to follow the dead. And I was a deadhead. And this is what's so great about this image. So I left. I was like, Blair, don't tell my parents if they call. There was no phone, so, you know, not going to happen anyway. But I went to hitchhike, and I was like, you know, I went to the edge of Ocean City. That's where we were, Ocean City, which was dry, by the way. And this is what I had with me. Like, cut-off overalls that I had gotten at the Goodwill, and a backpack, a JanSport backpack. And I had sewn a dancing bear onto the back of it, and it had my initials on it, because it was from high school. So that's what I went to follow the Grateful Dead in. You know, so that was when I was, you know, turning 19. That was between my freshman and sophomore years of college. All right, so fast forward about 7 months, and I wake up in a brain injury rehab ward in a hospital, in a bed, and I look around, and my mom's there, and there are cards everywhere and flowers, and the first thing I remember is this whiteboard, and my friends had drawn, like, cute messages and, like, little pictures on it, and I was just so confused. And also, my dad told me earlier tonight that he had also been there, but I completely had forgotten about that. So I was agitated. I was anxious. I mean, my startle response was just off the charts. I didn't know what had happened at all. The last thing that I'd remembered before that was driving from Missoula, Montana, to Boulder, Colorado, which is where I went to school. And we left in the early evening. It was around 6. We were trying to get back for morning classes, which was just stupid. I was with two of my friends, And we had this whole plan where we were going to have shifts. And, you know, one of us would drive the first third, second third, third third, and another person would stay awake to keep the driver awake, and then the other person would sleep in the back. And it was a Jeep Cherokee, so you could put the seats down, and one of us would sleep in a sleeping bag. So I drove my shift. I then was the active passenger, and it was a really nice memory, really peaceful. I loved these people that I was with, and then I went to sleep. And so then I woke up in this head injury rehab ward, and I found out, what I learned about what had happened was this. After I fell asleep, my friend who got the worst shift in the middle of the night was driving, and it was in the middle of Wyoming, and I don't know who's from the West, but you drive really fast in the middle of Wyoming in the middle of the night. And the other friend had fallen asleep, not surprisingly, you know, it was really late, and the driver fell asleep, and she veered off the road, and she hit the rumble strip, and the rumble strip woke her up, and she over-rotated, she over-corrected, and she rolled the car 3.5 times, and we landed on the roof of the car, and amazingly, the two people in the front seats were in seatbelts, and they were just hanging upside down, and one of them cut his hand, and that was it. They were fine physically. I was in the sleeping bag and got thrown out sideways beyond where the car landed. The sleeping bag actually probably helped me, and I was asleep, and that probably helped me. But when I woke up, what was not in the sleeping bag was, you know, had been like abraded by the highway, and I lost a pretty big chunk of my scalp, which has been repaired over many years. So, although when I woke up, it wasn't there, and I was like, "What is going on up here?" So, you know, that was pretty traumatic for my friends, who, by the way, I'm still very good friends with. My friend who was driving, they were very disoriented, obviously after flipping, and they got out of their seatbelts and they got out of the car, and. Because I had skidded, my head was bleeding profusely, and I was obviously totally unconscious, and I was in the middle of a highway in the middle of Wyoming, and it was like a scene out of a David Lynch movie, you know? And they were so disoriented that they thought I was dead, and there were no cell phones, so they waited at 3 a.m. until a trucker came along and called an ambulance. So that's what happened. And my friend, by the way, who drove, even though, you know, she knows that I'm doing well, she says she still thinks about that every day. You know, it's really, like, that kind of situation isn't just, it doesn't just injure the person who's obviously injured. It injures all the people that are involved, even though it was a single car accident. So there I am in the hospital. I had been withdrawn from college, and the doctors come in. They say that you've had a diffuse axonal injury. And this was in the early 90s, and I didn't know what that meant. They called it a closed head injury. I had fractured my skull, but nothing had entered my brain. It basically means a diffuse axonal injury or a closed head injury is when nothing enters the brain. You haven't had a stroke, so it's not localized. So they're not going to say, well, it's your motor area, so you're going to have trouble moving, or it's your speech area, so you're going to have trouble producing speech or processing speech. They just don't know. You know, they don't know. And really, they almost are ready to send you home when your external wounds are healed, even though you are completely shaken to the core. So this is what this is the prognosis. And the thing is, many people have had brain injuries, closed head injuries, so some of you will probably relate to this, but they came in and they said, and it's funny because I teach now my MBA students empathy, and I use people from Boston Children's Hospital who teach physicians empathy. These people had not yet taken that course because the doctor came in and said, so you are probably not going to finish college, so that's okay because you're going to be high functioning. And just FYI, in case any of you are physicians, we don't like that term. Like, high functioning is not satisfying to somebody who's just been, you know, told, oh, your whole life is going to be different. So they said, find something else to do. You know, it's going to be okay. You'll find something else to do. I had so many neuropsychological tests, so much cognitive, so many things happening. I remember them taking me to the grocery store to teach me how to shop for groceries again. And I took many days of neuropsych tests, and I got this full long report. It was like 25 pages long. I didn't know what neuropsych tests they had given me, but I looked through it, and I noticed one page, which was IQ. And now, I'm not saying anything about the validity of the IQ test or whether or not it's a good predictor of who does well in life. What I am saying is that people identify with it. It's quantifiable, right? It's this score that you attach to. They never they just sent me that 25-page report with no explanation, but I looked through it, and I saw that my IQ had dropped by 30 points. And that is, for the stats nerds, 2 standard deviations. It's massive. And I knew this because I was in the gifted program as a kid, and I knew my IQ. In fact, I remembered the letter that they sent home to my parents with the number circled. I remembered exactly what it looked like. And so I knew how big a drop that was. But here's part of the craziness of head injury in doctors is that they sort of exploit the fact that you're head injured, and they don't tell you much. You know, you sort of experience the same discrimination that older people experience, which is that they don't give you full information. So nobody really explained it to me. I just saw that, and I was pretty destroyed by that. So basically, the doctors were telling me, you're not smart anymore, you know? And that was a core part of my identity. And it was, as I said, it was something that I thought was fixed that could never change. So there was that. Then my closest friends tell me, you're not really the same person anymore. And that summer when I went home, the accident was in February, I went home for the summer, and my 2 best friends from high school, who were people that I was really close with, these were special friendships. Like, these are the kinds of friendships that I hope my son has. These were people who saw me. They knew me. They knew me as well as I knew myself, at least. And I think that it was such a time of confusion that the fact that I still had these 2 girls really made me feel, it gave me a sense of safety. And one night, and I don't know why, I don't know what led to this, one of them said to me, we can't be friends with you anymore. You're really, really different, and we don't know you anymore. We don't understand you. And I talked to the other friend, and she agrees. The other friend wasn't there. It was the worst, most devastating breakup of my life. I mean, it was horrible. I was crushed by it. And I thought, if they don't know me, and I don't know myself, and they can't tell me why I'm different or how I'm different, what am I going to do? And I remember it was a flashbulb memory for me. I remember driving home in the rain, sobbing, you know, thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do. I spent the next couple of years, next year probably, really confused. I don't remember a lot of things. And in fact, to try to piece things together again, I would do this thing where I would say to my friends, hey, remember when this happened? And they'd be like, oh yeah, that was so great. I'd be like, yeah, what did I say again? You know, so I would sort of be prying for information. Like, I'd be trying to get information about who I was by fake reminiscing with my friends. So I had that going on. I was miserable. I was angry. I was frustrated. I had no answers. I tried to go back to school, and I could not process spoken information. And it was like gobbledygook. Like, I would be in class, and it made no sense to me, which made me more frustrated. And I was failing out, so I had to quit. So that was the first time I went back. What I was really trying to do, you know, not understanding what was wrong with me or what was different, except that my doctors told me I was different, my friends told me I was different, and I knew that I was different, and I felt hollow, and I trying to hold on to who I was like trying to hold water in your hands. It just didn't make any sense to me. But what I was doing, I think, was I was passing. And I was talking to a friend of mine who was telling me about how he tried to pass as straight in high school. And he said, I never did it well. I would sort of like fake this behavior, But I never did it well because I didn't understand what it felt like to be straight. And I felt like I was trying to pass as my old self, but I didn't understand what it felt like to be my former self. So I couldn't possibly do it well, you know. And I was just really destroyed by this idea that I had lost this core part of my identity. Core parts of my identity, not just being smart, but my friends who I love telling me you're different and we don't want to be with you anymore. I really struggled with anxiety. I kept trying to go back, and I think I kept trying to go back because, honestly, and I'm not proud of this, but I can't take no for an answer, and if somebody tells me I can't have something, you know, if somebody says, oh, you're not going back to college, I'm like, oh, yeah, I am going back to college. So I kept trying and trying, even if I shouldn't have gone back to college. I tried again. It finally took the third time. So the third time I went back, it stuck. I was studying circles around everybody else. I felt like a total imposter. I felt like an imposter, not just at school, but I felt like an imposter in my own body. I didn't feel like I deserved to be there. Part of why it stuck that time was because I found something that I wanted to study. I wanted to study head injury because I realized after this experience, you know, that we knew so little about this, tiny, tiny, tiny amount about closed head injury. And for some reason, it wasn't as sexy as other kinds of head injury, or maybe it was just so hard to image, you know, diffuse axonal injury that people weren't studying it, but I really became motivated to study it. It turned out my brother also had a really serious head injury before I did. He fell off a cliff skiing, and he was discharged from the hospital when his wounds were healed. No, he had no follow-up therapy at all. So I knew that this was a problem. And there I was in Boulder at this top head injury rehab hospital because of all the skiing and climbing accidents. So if they didn't have an answer there, I really didn't know who had an answer. So I started working in this head injury lab, studying mild brain trauma. And what I was looking at was the effect of mild brain trauma on prospective memory, and that is remembering to remember. So remembering to come to an appointment down the road, you know, something like that. I worked in there for a year, and the faculty member that took me, the professor who took me in, I really think he took me in because he found me fascinating because I was brain injured, and I think he thought I had a lot of chutzpah, you know? So he was like, all right, you're interesting. He was very direct. He was from New York. You know, he was not like a typical sort of laid-back Coloradan. And I was always asking people who I thought might know, tell me more about head injury. I want to understand it. And he said to me, look, Amy, let me explain it to you in the simplest way, a diffuse axonal injury. He said, your brain's an onion. And let me just say here that I'm going to offend neurologists and neuroscientists by simplifying this, so apologies. He said, imagine that your brain's an onion and every layer or part is a different density. So when there is, you know, an acceleration force that's great enough, all of those parts are moving at different speeds against each other. And what's happening is that those neural fibers, those axons that are connecting all those parts of your brain from the primitive parts to the most evolved parts are dying. All of those axons died. So you've experienced a little death all over your brain. And so what that means is that you don't change in one way. Your affect changes, your intelligence changes, your behavior changes, your movement changes, your personality changes. Everything changes a little bit. And that is why we can't tell you this is what you should expect. This is what's going to happen. And that was a huge relief to me and also really unsettling at the same time, you know? I mean, I'm never going to get the answers that I want to get. I ended up leaving the lab, not because I didn't like working with this person, but I realized, this was in the mid-90s, that it wasn't going anywhere. That area just still had no momentum. No one seemed to care. It wasn't interesting enough, and I wasn't getting the answers that I wanted to get. So, you know, I ended up leaving and going into another area of psychology. And I don't know, you know, when people say, well, what is different about you now? The craziness of head injury, part of it is that I don't know, because I can't remember. You know, I just don't know what I was like before. I only know what I am like now. I don't know how I ended up at Harvard. It was never on the radar for me, ever. And I ended up at Harvard studying how people can become their aspirational selves. Like, how can you become a self that you're not now? And I realized that, and it's funny because, like, part of it is just giving these talks, and, you know, this was really hard, thinking about this and having to process this and go over this, and even just talking to my dad about it, and that the hardest breakup wasn't with my best friends. What happened was that I realized I had a moment where I realized that I had to break up with my past self, that I was never going to be that person again, and that we weren't communicating well anymore, you know? It's like in a relationship when you, it's not terrible, like you're kind of comfortable, but you don't know each other anymore, you're drifting apart, and you just know that you're never going to know each other again, you're never going to come back together again, and you have to let it go. I had to let it go, and I felt guilty, I felt ashamed, I felt, it was really hard. I felt like I was dishonoring my true self, this idea of the true self, that the true self was the person I was before the accident, and I could no longer ever again be my true self. But I had to break up with myself, and that's what I did. And I, you know, when you break up with someone in that situation, you don't know what's out there. Like, you don't know if you're going to meet another companion. You're taking a leap of faith, and that is what I had to do. And I think that if I had not been able to make that break, and that break was really hard for me to make, nothing would have happened. Thank you.
That was Amy Cuddy. Amy is a social psychologist and Harvard Business School associate professor who studies how snap judgments and nonverbal behavior affect people from the classroom to the boardroom. Her fascinating work on power posing reveals how your physical posture affects not only how others see you, but also how you see yourself, your own hormone levels, and your performance and important life outcomes. Amy's work has been featured on CNN, MSNBC, The New York Times, The Financial Times, Scientific American Mind, The Wall Street Journal, and even as the theme of a Dilbert comic strip. Her TED Talk is now the second most viewed of all time. She's also a classically trained and still practicing ballet dancer, which informs her research on nonverbal communication. For more science stories, take a look at storycollider.org, where you have archives of the podcast and upcoming events. Also, we depend on listeners like you for our support. If you're able, please consider donating, storycollider.org/donate. We also have shows coming up in Queens, Brooklyn, London, and Boston. Head to storycollider.org for dates and times. The Story Collider is produced by me, Brian Wecht, Aaron Barker, and Ari Daniel. The podcast is produced by Rose Avalith. Additional help from Brooke Williams, Lena Groger, and Justin D'Ambrosio. The theme music is by Ghost. Special thanks to the Bell House for hosting the show, and to the world for sometimes being okay with change. Thanks for listening.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.